My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the second in the series on Jesus and Power, day two with the P word. I went to Joe Jordan's session yesterday to learn about ozone, and he had page after page of formulae. I haven't worked out the formula for Jesus and Power yet, but we're getting started here. P equals C today. That's power as coercion. That's the subject today. So we'll work on that this week. I want to introduce the topic of Jesus and Power in a different way today than I did yesterday. This is a kind of an extending yesterday's introduction. Yesterday, I said that I was motivated to investigate Jesus and Power in order simply to understand the recurring testimony that Jesus is and was a power in people's lives, that God is always associated with power, and that I wanted to talk to folks in order to hear how they describe the kind of power associated with God and with Jesus. Yesterday I also said that I'm interested in this subject because power is simply a reality in all of our lives, and I want to understand my experience of power and our observations about it, and then see how the look at the biblical materials puts us in conversation with our own experience of power. Now, there's another motivation for the subject, and that's what I want to use as today's introduction, and that is the place of human power in our era. I think that the distinctive mark of our epoch is the quantum leap in the impact of human power to affect all of life in unprecedented ways. So there's a sense of urgency about looking at power because we live in a time when the increase of human power in particular affects a novel range. There are novel objects and consequences of enhanced knowledge and power. It is heightened human power that is bringing people around the globe within striking distance of each other's lives, for better and for worse. Whether the subject is a radical intervening in basic life processes, the new powers of biotechnologies, for example. To this point, until our epoch, we shaped the environment around us sort of from the outside. With biotechnology, you work on the basic fundamental units of life and you change life from the inside with affecting the genes, for example. That's a new power. It's an awesome power. It's only in its infancy. Or whether we talk about the plausible and actual termination of life on a grand scale. Before the atomic age, people killed one another. They were never capable, ever, of putting human beings in a situation where one was capable of actually becoming uncreators, of terminating human life as we know it on this particular piece of God's real estate. That's a new power. Or whether we're talking about the heightened and cumulative impact of human effects, especially from industrial society, on the planetary environment, acid rain, ozone layer, greenhouse effects. All of those are novel consequences. All of those represent novel objects of enhanced human power. I'm just underscoring my point that it is the distinctive mark of our epoch that human power has reached these kinds of proportions with these kinds of consequences. Or whether we talk about the gathering and dispersion of vast quantities of information, mass media, electronic technologies. We've never moved information around the world like we can and do now. Now we're going on Wall Street in New York, we're going to round the clock, selling and buying using the computer programs, because the market's a global market. And London's open at a different time than Japan is open, and Japan's open at different hours than the United States is. In electronic technologies represent a leap. Or whether we're talking about the integration of systems on a global scale, the integration of the world economies, that's something new. All right. My point is everywhere the same, namely that greatly increased powers now rest in human hands and affect life in unprecedented and fundamental ways. Now, how are we to think about these powers? How shall we think about them theologically, to be precise? How shall we think about these enhanced human powers up against the theological conviction that God is the source of all power? How shall we think of our responsibility as moral responsibility up against that conviction that God is the source of all power and the one to whom we are accountable for the power we hold? Thus, I want to talk about Jesus and power. These new powers are already so much with us that we almost fail to nod our head in wonderment when we come across what is a rather startling sentence. I'm reading now from James Gustafson, not a professor of Christian ethics who is not given to exaggeration. And Jim Gustafson says, quote, "The balance of accountability for the ordering of life in our time has shifted in a sense from God to humanity, and is shifting more rapidly in this century than in all of the previous centuries of human culture combined. The balance of accountability for the ordering of life has shifted in a sense from God to humanity, and is shifting more rapidly in this century than in all the previous centuries of human culture combined." So, that's an extended word of introduction as to a further motivation for wanting to talk about Jesus and power, and power in human hands. Okay, having added this to yesterday's introduction, or today we're going to turn to a specific form, specific kind of human power, and talk about it, and tomorrow we'll talk about another one, and then the next day, yet another. Today's P equals C. Power equals coercion. Power has force today. Now, time to sing. The hymn, the hymn is 389. I hope you can find someone there with whom to look on. It's quite familiar. You can't sit and sing stand up for Jesus. You gotta stand up. Oh. You gotta sing all four verses today, so that I don't give you the wrong instructions. That's power, Larry. That's funny. You can smell. Singing about in that song. Huh?
Bloody power.
Bloody power.
I guess it was God's power.
God's power. Yes. We're back in catechism class here. Always waiting for the right answer. The right answer is always God's power. All right. What are the images of power in this hymn?
Military strength.
Lots of it. We've got soldiers. What else? Is that it all the way through? Just military images? Well, they're certainly there.
Victory.
Victory?
Conflictual.
Yeah, conflict. This is a battle hymn. Yeah. There's a war going on.
It's political, the royal banner.
Yes, it's very political. We're on the side of the conquerors here. Royal banner, we must be fighting for kings. The King of Glory shall reign eternally.
It's corporate.
It's corporate.
It's an army, not just one.
Yeah, no, this isn't just one of us. We're all marching here together in step. Yeah.
There's a lot of enemies.
There are enemies.
Yeah.
Who are the enemies?
It's Christ.
A number is lots of enemies. Whoa! I've got an idea. I'm going to work on that formula. What is the word for unlimited? I mean, the symbol for unlimited.
Infinity.
No, not exactly infinity. We can't do that. That's too easy. We've got to find that symbol for unlimited
more
for
than.
Enemies. Okay. All right. Against unnumbered foes. Who are these enemies? This marching battle. Bearing the banner of the king is fighting against.
Well, the third verse changes to gospel armor. So
gospel armor. What kind of
armor? And demons or something. Mm-hmm. But
demons.
You know, if we're going to be spiritual about it, that's what we're supposed to think. But the song itself makes you think of all those people in the world that are bad. That you should get them.
This is spiritual. It says the armor of flesh will fail you.
Yeah.
But it stand up.
You dare not trust your own flesh. You put your trust elsewhere. Now, what would gospel armor be?
It's the
breastplate, whatever. Ephesians, what does
it say?
Whole armor of God.
Put on the whole armor of God. We got a breastplate of righteousness.
It sort of sounds like the hymn you'd sing to rally against the evil empire.
Uh-huh.
Peace through strength. Strength to strength oppose.
But we are fighting. One line.
We are fighting an evil empire here of some kind.
But what about the arm of flesh will fail you if you dare not trust your own?
Well.
And then what they're getting out of this is the crown of life.
Yes. And reigning with the King of Glory. Eternally. I mean, we get in on the reign. We're with the winners on this one.
Is this a civil war? I mean, it's the right time period.
I don't know. I wish you'd ask that question before.
It's in Carol's room.
No point looking. I tried.
I'd like to know the answer to that question. Whence did the hymn arise? What's the context as well as the conflict?
Salvation Army thing?
I don't know. There is a certain amount of power as force in the hymn. All right? Yeah. The images here are images of power as coercion. It's a real crusade hymn. And it's straightforward, militaristic. Metaphors. And they're in the biblical materials. Someone already mentioned the Pauline materials. You get a bit of it in Jesus. You're fighting demons. There is a picture, which is an apocalyptic picture, of a great battle between good and evil. And you choose on whose side you will be. There's a way of life. And there's a way of death. And great is the difference between them. So the images themselves are have their biblical counterparts in the New Testament materials, do you think this is the power you would associate with Jesus? If we all stood up and sang, stand up for Jesus, and went marching, would Jesus march with us on this one?
No.
No.
Don't think so.
I always feel kind of paranoid when I sing that. There's a lot of paranoid thoughts behind that. It's all black or white, and I don't associate Jesus with that. Paranoid kind of ideation.
Mm.
At the temple,
very uncomfortable.
Drove out the money changers, he was pretty vehement.
Yeah, the rage at the power and the principalities and the powers in the temple. Mm-hmm.
I guess I just associate this kind of thing with the times throughout history that Christians have gone on crusade type things against people and viewed them that as being okay because these people are heathen and we really have to convert them.
Mm-hmm.
And God would want us to do this. And so I just see throughout history how Christians have been so self-righteous against people that they that are different and trying to coerce them through power.
Yeah. Now this is a real crusader's, in that context of a crusader's hymn.
Is it physical or is it spiritual he's talking about here? Yeah, third verse. Talks about how we're going to put our strength in Him alone, and
yeah,
you know, this isn't a crusade type of thing. I mean, it's a spiritual crusade, not a physical crusade.
No, they aren't named. If it were, until every foe is vanquished, easily slides over to foes that you can see. But you're right. The hymn text itself does not identify. Say, a pogrom against the Jews, or a crusade to liberate the Holy Land. Yeah.
About a revolution to overthrow a dictator.
Let me tell you a story about this hymn. I haven't liked this hymn for a long time because I don't associate it with kind of power that I see, that I glimpse in Jesus. And so I shirk from this. I like Hold High the Cross a little better. It's got a bit of that kind of tone about it as well. But the organist at our congregation came to church one evening to practice, get ready for Sunday morning. And this hymn was being sung by a group that had gathered around the altar. And this was on a Thursday afternoon or some unlikely time for church. And this was clearly a group that had just gathered there to pray and to sing together. So he politely waited until they had finished. And then he spotted one in the group that he knew, so he asked him, what's the occasion? It was a group of Namibians in New York, and that week the forces of South Africa had withdrawn from Angola to be concentrated in northern Namibia. And they had gathered to pray and to sing. And they had sung Stand Up for Jesus as a way of taking courage against the South Africans. Your example? An example. Their association with this hymn was against a real foe in this case. And they had chosen the hymn because it had some resonance with their own quest for a free nation. But it is also a hymn of sort of Charlemagne's offer. You know, I've got an offer you can't refuse. Be baptized or die. it's very often associated with that kind of world in which Christianity is, where throne and altar are married, and it's easy to see who the foes of Christ are, and it plays into that kind of mentality. But Deanne's comment and the illustration of the Namibians is a way of saying that it might also be turned to be a hymn for those who see the foes as the foes who in fact hold the royal banners at present and ought not to be in power. In either case, it's power P equals C that we're talking about here. And I want now to dwell a little bit on power as coercion, talk about its dynamics, because our purpose is to describe it and to put that description then to Christian reflection.
Mary?
Yeah.
So it is, I don't want to sidetrack too much, but you said it, in either case it's power as coercion. But is power as defense the same as power as coercion?
Well, that's the use of force.
If you're, okay.
It may be a justified use of force. The Kairos document from South Africa, I think, is persuasive in its saying that if a person is being raped, it's a justified use of force to throw off that person if it's possible, or to defend against that. That's still power as force, power as coercion. We're talking. I don't mean to jump to a conclusion, and I don't mean to intimate that all uses of power as force are illegitimate or unjust. So I'm not equating every instance of its use as morally equivalent instances. One needs to differentiate among them. But it seems to me that it's still the same kind of force, even though it's morally assessed differently in different cases. Is that still problematic?
Well, I have to think about it. I just, yeah.
Yeah. I hope I didn't give someone a shock in the ear there. My apologies. I think if we continued your point very long, we would show that we had entered a long debate in Christian history about the use of power as force of coercion, the sword, and in a related way, the law, and the place of the law, and the place of the sword. And I only want to say at the outset that the ambivalence that I feel about singing this hymn is an ambivalence that people of Christian faith have felt about power as coercion when they reflect upon it. Christians can never make up their minds whether their faith mandates that they be pacifists and take a vow of nonviolence, or whether they approve a justified use of coercion, including controlled and violent means of force. Now that's, as you well know, that's a long-standing debate, and your question would provoke it. Having acknowledged that, having made that point, I only want to now go on to talk about one person and use materials from one person who has given more thought to power as coercion as a subject for Christian reflection than probably any other, at least in modern times. That's Reinhold Niebuhr. And I'm going to use a little bit of Reinhold Niebuhr's work as the way for us now to discuss the dynamics of power as coercion and our experience of that, and then see how we think that fits with what we understand to be the power that we see in Jesus. How does it line up? How does it relate to that? Let me do that by simply taking some theses in good Lutheran fashion here, from a book that Reinhold Niebuhr wrote called Moral Man and Immoral Society. He decided later on the title should be changed to Immoral Man and Even More Immoral Society. but that's a little bit beside the point. And I'll just lift some contentions of Niebuhr from that book in order that we might talk about power as force, power as coercion. See whether you agree or disagree with Niebuhr. There is no ethical force strong enough to place inner checks upon the use of power if its quantity is inordinate. There is no ethical force strong enough to place inner checks upon the use of power if its quantity is inordinate. Lord Acton said it a little bit differently. Power tends to corrupt an absolute power. Absolutely. Lord Acton didn't say power corrupts an absolute power, absolutely. He said power tends to corrupt an absolute power, absolutely. Niebuhr is saying, by implication, that you always, if power is concentrated, moral suasion and even inner moral strength will not sufficiently check the exercise and the workings of that power. And his conclusion from that is that you always have to organize countervailing power to check the abuses of power. For Niebuhr, evil flows from unbalanced power. So you all, and moral argument and moral suasion will not check that if it is unbalanced. It requires the organization of countervailing power. Agree? Disagree?
I strongly agree with that. My work involves me in dealing with power issues a lot, because mm-hmm. I work in management, labor kinds of uh-huh. situations. And
which side are you on?
Both.
Both. Whoa.
Yeah. I consult the labor unions, and I consult and I consult the management. And I'm in this somewhat interesting situation where I often will consult the management. Managers will often try to hire me to help bust unions because mm-hmm. I'm a management consultant. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the stance that I take is that their organization can be more effective if they have a union in place, because then they have a way of ensuring that there is a check and balance on the power of management. Mm-hmm. And that results in there being less abuses of power in its evil sense, and more likelihood of power being something that's there for people to do better work and do more work. Mm-hmm. So I like the Niebuhr mm-hmm. construction better than the Acton one.
I see.
Because it does, it leads to that conclusion that I, uh-huh. on a pragmatic level, come to.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, I'll wait for some of the implications for thinking about this in terms of religious communities. I do think that it has often been the case that religious communities make moral appeal when they see abuses of power, and often tend to be naive about the necessity of organizing countervailing power. And to do that seems to me to just Niebuhr's right. contention. It's to assume that moral suasion has more power than in fact it does. I think the Roman Catholic bishops' outstanding letter on the economy fails at that point. It puts a kind of confidence in moral suasion to check concentrated power that probably isn't borne out by your and other people's experience. But it's a strong tendency of religious communities to do that.
The parallel in organizations is the rise of human resource specialists.
I
whose
see.
Job is to be the moral, the conscience of management.
Uh-huh.
It never works.
Because
people eventually find out that who the human resource specialists actually work for,
so.
And they don't. The moral suasion that they try to exert, no matter how, as individuals, they try to approach that, the structural inequality can't be overcome by their techniques and programs and approaches.
There's also, conscience is also tricky. Now I'm using it in a different sense than you are, and there's a very important role to play for one group to be a conscience, and religious communities have had that kind of vocation as well, and it's a very important one. But when just the word itself triggers, to my mind, a comment by Jakob Burckhardt, who said, "I wrestled all night with my conscience, and I won." we always win. So the moral check of conscience,
right.
You know, is susceptible to be overcome by our interests, which are served by the powers that we have and which serve the power that we have. Yeah. I keep forgetting when we start and when we finish. Did we start at about 10 of, and do we finish about 10 of?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to get through enough of this so that we can spend a little time at the end being a little more deliberate about Christian reflection. But Joe just came in, and Joe, I started out by saying that I haven't caught up to you yet with pages of formula, but we're starting on Jesus in power, and P equals C, that's power equals coercion, okay? Not chlorine. all right, this
carbon,
yes, chlorine is Cl. Another contention that we've already touched on, but for the sake of moving into Niebuhr's thought here on power and force, the contention that both social gradations, strata in society, and evil consequences flow from imbalances and disproportions of power. If you were Reinhold Niebuhr and you wanted to explain the ordering of peoples in society, you would ask, what's the structure of power in this society? That's how you would get the answers. And if you wanted to say, how does injustice arise, you would ask the question, what is the ordering of power in the society? Further, that while any kind of social power develops social inequality, all social cooperation on a larger scale than the most intimate groups requires a measure of coercion. Social power develops social inequalities, but any measure of social cooperation also requires a measure of power as coercion. Coercion, then, for Niebuhr, is both a social necessity and a social danger. The same power that makes for social peace makes for social injustice, is his contention. Power as force, power as coercion, is both necessary and, so to say, unacceptable. It makes for social peace. At some level, it also generates injustice. Social justice for Niebuhr is not possible apart from coercion. Got anybody wants to take them on at that point? Can you have social justice without coercion? Yeah.
I don't know if you want to take it on or what it
take it in a different direction. You can ask the question, do you have social justice without coercion? Can you have social justice with only coercion?
Niebuhr says no.
Because sometimes I use this example with my students, which is the I gave at the office syndrome. You have rules, okay, to ensure justice. We have the United Way. Okay, so you give your money at the office to the United Way. Some hungry person shows up at your door. You say, oh, I gave to United Way. Go away. I did what I'm supposed to do. So I think, no, you can't have it. I don't think you can have it without coercion because we're unlikely to always do what we should do. But the coercion that comes from rules won't ensure. Well, last week when we were hearing about Hosea and Amos, justice with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure you can have justice without compassion, and you don't get compassion only from coercion.
Yeah. Those are helpful remarks. Niebuhr would agree with those. It's necessary, it's not sufficient.
Yeah.
It's never sufficient. But you won't have social justice without it.
Seems like so many of the throughout history governments or regimes that have tried to be progressive and but have slipped more and more into coercion as being the primary mode have then moved into being counterproductive in that way. When coercion finally becomes the only mode that's left for the government to try and enforce what they see as a just vision, and then they become unjust.
And then one gets into kind of classic case. Of ends undermining means or working against them. Or to take it maybe the direction you were going, Dan, in Niebuhr's term, since countervailing power is needed to check or to destroy oppressive power, the question then becomes how to make the new power constellation morally responsible or just. There is a cycle, I mean, Domhelder Kammerer's spiral of violence, that operates both from the side of those who are wielding oppressive power and those who must organize power as coercion in order to throw it off. It tends to spiral both sides. Yeah. Here's an interesting one from this book. The most pervasive, effective, and common uses of power are covert. They are subtly socialized and institutionalized. Most citizens in a democracy are unaware of the degree of coercion present. Of a great deal of our everyday behavior, in fact, is participating in coercive channeling of energy. But it's so much a part of our way of seeing things that we don't recognize it and call it coercion or force. There are people in a society who experience it that way, who need to then tell you that that's what it is, because we don't see it that way. It seems natural to us. And in a democracy, it probably becomes legitimated because you said we all had our say in electing these folks, making these laws. So it doesn't seem like it's a coercive power because we participated in the making of it, and we don't think of it then somehow as being forced, or at least we normally don't. One of the better definitions of democracy, I think, that's just straightforwardly honest about it and insightful about it, is one which says democracy is mutual coercion mutually agreed upon.
So is legitimate, you're saying legitimation issue doesn't, you don't separate one form of coercion from the other based on that legitimation, whether it's a process of legitimation.
I don't follow you yet.
That's where I would draw the line, that coercive power, that there is a line between coercive power, that there is some kind of legitimation, you know, due process,
yeah,
you know, so forth, versus coercive power where there isn't that kind of legitimation process. That's the way I would differentiate one kind of coercive power from another.
Yeah, and as a moral assessment of
right.
it.
Right, and you're saying yeah. Niebuhr doesn't do that.
No, I thank you for that. No, I'm just saying that Niebuhr is just trying to point out that very often coercive power is, to us, very covert. Mm-hmm. And part of the time it is in a democracy because we feel we've participated in the arranging of it. And so we hardly view it as force mm-hmm. or as coercion. Another one that you might want to spend a bit of time with here, the social privileges generated by disproportionate power need not be economic, but usually are. He means in the modern world. He's actually writing in the 30s, so you need to remember that. He says there, in that book, economic power is more basic than political power. Now here's an example of power as force and coercion appearing quite covert. Economic power in the systems about which Niebuhr was most familiar with, and he's writing in late Depression, is one which talks a great deal, as we did in this last decade, about free markets and the operation of the market place, as though that were a thing in itself, not constructed by various constellations of human power. It sort of runs on its own, plays out its consequences. And for Niebuhr, he would say, you're just kidding yourselves. There may be something about free market, but it's a human construct. It's a human set of arrangements. It's a particular way of putting economic power together. So don't, and it's coercion. It's force. So don't call it something else. I'm just going to finish these and then make sure that we do have some reflection time. Religion will always intensify power dynamics. Religious humility and self-deprecation will tend to foster sacrifice of power and even powerlessness. People will accept their relative lack of power if there's a strong religious reason, meaning for doing so. It's good to self-sacrifice. Religious pride and the cosmic significance of the self and the self's communities given sanction by religion will tend to foster extremism and absolutism. Religion is humility before the absolute and self-assertion in terms of the absolute, Niebuhr says. So, even as a Puritan, you got down on your knees in prayer before the Almighty God, and when you stood up, you had your foot on the neck of the king. Religious vitality will invariably strengthen power dynamics. That is, religion will always intensify both powerlessness and the assertion of power, is what Niebuhr is saying. Now, Niebuhr always says always, and then he usually qualifies it, but he tends to make the unqualified statement and let you work with that. Here's one that'll surprise some of you if you know Niebuhr, because Niebuhr is often viewed as a kind of cold warrior, since he argued so strongly on theological and moral grounds for the participation of the United States in taking up arms against Nazi Germany when Nazi people were saying, stay out of the war. Quote, the nonviolent coercion and resistance is a type of coercion which offers the largest opportunities for a harmonious relationship with the moral and rational factors in social life. It does not destroy, that is, nonviolent resistance, nonviolent coercion. Please note one thing, that's coercion. Nonviolent resistance is coercion. It's power used as force. There's a nice cartoon from the New Yorker that showed up back in the days of Bull Connor and the Civil Rights Movement. They had a big policeman or a sheriff and a white and a little black African American, and the sheriff says, don't go getting nonviolent with me, boy. That was some sense of a power over there, force. Nonviolence resistance is a kind of force. And so Niebuhr says, however, it is a type of coercion which offers the largest opportunities for a harmonious relationship with the moral and rational factors in social life. It does not destroy the process of a moral and rational adjustment of interest to interest completely during the course of resistance. There is no problem of political life to which religious imagination can make a larger contribution than this problem of developing nonviolent resistance. Okay, finally then. That the power impulses in society, and he means power, P equals C here, the power impulses in society are finally impulses of human nature itself and will persist whatever the forms of social organization. Do you believe that? We'll never have society without the exercise of power as coercion, because it belongs to the nature of human nature. So it doesn't matter what the social organization is, there is no social organization that banishes coercion. That's his contention. Does that sit with your picture of the reign of God? Nobody got any problems with that? We don't have a utopian in the room? I'm one. Sure. As in heaven, that's the theme.
It depends on, I guess, how we're talking about coercion. Because if you're talking about people doing things because the society is set up in such a way that to do that is in the best interest of that person, if that's coercion, then I would say no, we won't ever have it. But I think that I do believe that there will be a time when people will do things that will be in their best interest, but it will be in their best interest because it's also in the interest of the society that they live in. And so no one will have to force them to do it in any way. Do you see what I mean? So I do believe that there will be a time when nobody's going to have to stand over them and say, this is the way it's going to be.
I'm on your side.
Because I really do think that if we do things that are in the interest of our planet and in the interest of humanity,
yeah,
it will be in our interest as well, like, yeah, as an individual.
Yeah.
And I think people will eventually learn that. I don't know how long it will take.
It was a great, great confidence earlier in the century that kind of enlightened self-interest and was a power, sufficient power, to bring about that kind of social harmony.
Well, the problem is that when you're dealing with any large organization, it's impossible for any one individual to know what is the right thing to do so that the organism as a whole works. And so that requires certain individuals to coordinate. And once you have individuals coordinating, you're also having individuals who are going to be coercing. I think the problem is we see coercion as always being bad, but that human beings as social animals require some sort of direction, and direction is a form of coercion. It's when, especially if you take an extreme individualist point of view, which means that you cannot be informed in detail why you have to do this at this particular point, mm-hmm. so the whole organism works. Because if we were doing that, we'd be spending all of our time in committee meetings and never, never living.
Yeah. Well, George Bernard Shaw said, the trouble with socialism is that it takes all your evenings. You'd all have to always be planning all of this stuff.
So are traffic laws coercive? I mean, that's a pretty benign thing, but...
Well, you put the force of law behind them so that folks have to obey those traffic laws.
Right, and I can't imagine that there would be a time where we wouldn't have things like traffic lines. And traffic lights are kind of coercive. I don't want to stop. I'm in a hurry. There are no cars coming. But I still have to stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in this time somewhere out in the future, if there's no cars coming, you don't have to stop. And if there are cars coming, then you would naturally stop because you don't want to kill that person or hurt yourself.
We
still have a rule about who stops.
We'll be out of paper ice cream and don't cut in line. The group will coerce you to not cut in line.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe you just wouldn't cut in line because you don't want the person behind you to cut in front of you, so you just do it because that's what you see.
It's enlightened self-interest.
Right.
But Mark's point is that we won't know what our enlightened self-interest is. And I actually didn't share with you the thesis of Niebuhr's book, but the thesis of Niebuhr's book is that it's impossible to transfer an ethic which works to some degree within intimate circles where you know one another well and know one another's needs well, to the field of large intergroup relations. It doesn't work the same way.
Yeah, perhaps you dealt with this at a previous time here, but what is the difference between an I persuasion and coercion?
Mm-hmm.
We live in a society that seems to me that lives on persuasion. I mean, we live in a visually oriented society that looks at the TV where we're regularly persuaded that we ought to do this or that or buy this or that.
Yeah. Is that coercion?
Yeah, is that coercion?
Is that kind of influence coercion?
Is that influence coercion? It's very easy to understand coercion if someone's, you know,
sure, these marching armies here in this hill.
You know, either do this or die.
Yeah.
But at what point is, what's persuasion and what's coercion?
Yeah.
Or rather the same.
I mean, I think one of the interesting developments in the last 20 years, and you see this in a variety of different disciplines, but especially in some feminist theory, but also in various theories of language, is that language is also coercive,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that it structures reality a certain way,
right.
where it allows you to move easily in some direction and not so easily in others.
Yeah.
And so ideation is ideology in a certain sense. And so you are coerced if you are in a society who says women are supposed to be subordinate to men. There's a coercion there, even though everyone may accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But there still is a form of coercion. I don't think that it can be escaped as long as we are social linguistic beings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, language bears our reality. I mean, that carries it. That's how we learn it, what it is. Yeah.
But isn't language and the act of communication a form of persuasion and therefore coercion? I mean, the very act itself, whatever it may bear.
Mm-hmm. We're already slipping over into power as ideology, which is the next session. and we can take up some of that. Our time is about out now, and so I'm, without carrying this important issue on further, I just want to move to the end and can pick up on some of that tomorrow. Or I can't remember the exact order, but one of these days we're going to talk about the process of socialization, language, shaping the way people see and understand things as a power, and pick up again then the relationship of that. Is that coercion, or what? And then this further question that was just raised back here, if coercion is pervasive, that's one thing. Distinguishing good coercion from bad coercion, don't make an assumption that all force is to be judged negatively. So that's another sort of thing. But I wanted to, before we move to the last part of the last one here, just point out an area of real tension. If you don't think that social harmony is possible, and coercion for it, now here we may have to get into what is good coercion and not. You are in some important kind of tension with a basic biblical contention, that picture of the redeemed society where the lion and the lamb lie down together and the child will play over the head of the adder. And remember that our elders in the faith, namely the Jews, have always contended that redemption happens in history.
But where in history? I mean, the chronology of the eschatology is pretty important, and whether it happens on this side of something catastrophic or that side of something catastrophic, it's still in history.
It's a historical possibility.
Yeah. Also, the images are agricultural and pastoral, where yeah. it's probably easier to conceive of these things, but we haven't lived in an agricultural, pastoral society in a long time.
Yeah. But the image is also the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay. Finally then, Niebuhr's contention that there is no sharp distinction between the will to live and the will to power. He's talking about human nature now. The human spirit is a curious mixture of the fear of extinction and the love of power, and an imperial reach easily attaches itself to the efforts to preserve life. Our very efforts to preserve what is uncontestably good are efforts which have an imperial reach about them. We don't easily distinguish between the will to live and the will to power. So while it is not from Niebuhr, but Walter Benjamin, this line I think is kind of Niebuhrian. There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism, or at least given to becoming such. Okay, my conclusions then are very, very quickly. Niebuhr is right for a Christian reflection on power about the pervasiveness of power in all relationships, all creation including, and power as coercion. Christians must come to terms with power as coercion if they are not going to be irresponsible or self-deceptive. Another conclusion, the other kinds of power than power as coercion are vitally important, perhaps even saving in our kind of world of the heightened impact of human power. The other kinds of power need to be explored, and to be explored in relationship to power as coercion. More on that later. We desperately need to develop kinds of power that go on beyond the mastery-slave power as power over and as power against, which is a primary, not the only form of power as coercion. But we need to relate those other kinds of power to that. Regarding Jesus, we may well see evidence of power as coercion or force in Jesus, casting out demons, the rage, and the cleansing of the temple. But the Gospels are simply not understandable if you read Jesus' power only as coercive power. Nor is Jesus' power understandable as if you read it as non-resistance to, as non-resistance to, in a quiescent sort of way, to principalities and power. There's some other kinds of power going on there with Jesus. power as coercion doesn't sum it up.